When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message: "Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono." But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply: "I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" Four times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his assistant to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king, so come, let us meet together." I sent him this reply: "Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your heads. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands." Okay, here's a new strategy. It's an old strategy. It's one of the strategies you will see used again and again throughout history. If you can't get the people to stop what they're doing, what do you need to do? Well, you need to find a way to discredit the leader. Okay, can we find a way to discredit Nehemiah? That's their plan, and you're going to see that carrying on in this section. This section is all about this. Okay, if everything Nehemiah is doing is being so successful, if we can just discredit him in some way, if we can just harm him in some way, well then, presumably, they'll stop rebuilding the walls, because no one was building any walls before he turned up anyway. As I said, this is something you will see again and again throughout history, and you will see again and again right now. You'll see it happening. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book. If you're opposed to the civil rights movement, then find any sort of dirt you can on Martin Luther King and just hope some of it sticks. If you don't like a policy which someone's proposing, it's starting to gain some widespread support, then leak some embarrassing information about the person, and then hopefully it'll just go away. So, Operation Bring Down Nehemiah begins. And first, they try something not that subtle. They basically say, "Oh, why don't you come and meet us in this place?" And he's like, seems like a bad idea. We're not told exactly what they intend to do. It's just to harm him. Who knows whether that means to kill him or to intimidate him or who knows. But when he refuses, we're told he refuses four times. When he refuses, they come up with this attempt. They're going to attempt to portray Nehemiah as a power-hungry insurrectionist. That's their goal. They know he's come with the blessing and protection of King Artaxerxes, one of the most powerful people of the time. And so they think, well, if we can just undermine that support, then Nehemiah loses his power, he loses his backing. At the moment, he's really powerful because he's got the backing of the king of Assyria. But if we can get rid of that, he's just one guy. We can do anything at that point. If they can get people, and crucially get Artaxerxes, to believe that Nehemiah is wanting to set himself up as a king in Judah, then his protection will disappear. Artaxerxes might even get rid of Nehemiah himself. He might do the dirty work for them. So Sanballat and Geshem, in essence, go to the press. That's what this open letter is. You get told that it's an unsealed letter. It's kind of one of these like public-facing letters so that everyone can see it, claiming that Nehemiah is trying to set himself up as king. You see, having ignored it to this point, Nehemiah having said, "Look, I'm not coming to meet you, I'm going to get on with this work," now he's forced to engage with it. He has to say something, but what he says is pretty brief, and you'll have noticed it there. "None of this is actually happening, you've just made it up." That's his response to it. Now, I'm going to move on into the rest of chapter 6 in a minute, but before we do that, I do just want to pause a little bit just to think about what this teaches us, or what we might want to think about in terms of how we deal with false accusations that come our way. Because that's what's going on here, right? People are claiming things about Nehemiah that aren't true. You might have had that in your life. You might be able to look back at times where people have said things about you that are untrue, and where, like Nehemiah potentially, you have had to work out, what are you going to do about that? Because the problem with false accusations, the problem when people say things about you that aren't true, is it can actually be really difficult to deal with. They can be quite hard to find your way out of. And they're hard to deal with because some people will believe them. Some people will believe them. And once they're out there, well, we're pretty powerless to stop people spreading them. And we're often pretty powerless to impact whether people believe them or not. If we engage with them and try and demonstrate why they're untrue, people think, oh, they seem a little bit defensive. And if you don't engage with them, then people go, oh, see, they've got nothing to say about it. You get stuck in this catch-22 situation where the false accusation's out there, but everything you do just seems to reinforce what people have chosen to believe about you. Now, Christians, of course, will face some false accusations. We get told that we are sexist or homophobic. We get told that we're judgmental and arrogant. Churches get accused of being cults without ever any real definition of what they mean by that word, but it's a pretty damaging word and label to get. And again, as with so many of these things, once they're out there, once someone said it, everyone finds themselves wondering to some degree, is that true? Now, as a church, we need to think about how we engage with these things. Because the first thing we've got to do when people are saying things about us is we've got to do a bit of examination of ourselves to check whether they are true or not, right? Like, we can't just assume, oh, they said something bad about us, so it's untrue. Maybe it is true. So the first thing you've got to do is you've got to examine yourself and go, hey, is there truth in this? Are there things I need to own that we have got wrong? Are there things that we need to repent of in this? But we do also need to make sure that we're not naive. As a church, we will face some false accusations and they will sting. They may well make us annoyed or angry or uncertain. But remember what the goal of these was. The goal of these false accusations was to derail the work that Nehemiah was supposed to be doing. And so what do we have to do in those moments? We have to not allow it to get in the way of what it is that God's called us to do. You know, Nehemiah's response in verse 3 is kind of the response we should be looking at. I'm carrying on a great project. Why should I leave the work and deal with this? You know, there's a degree to which we can't let it get in the way of the work that God has called us to do. For Nehemiah, that was building the wall. For us, well, we've got to make sure that we don't allow those things to get in the way of us, of our goal to love him, to make him known, to seek to love the town in which God has placed us and the people that he's put around us. That's what God has specifically called us to do. And we mustn't allow any of these things to derail us or get in the way of like that. Like Nehemiah, where these are untrue, we simply say they are untrue. And then we just get back on with the work that God's prepared for us to do. But they don't give up at this point. If you've got your Bible open, which hopefully you still do, let's carry on in verse 10 and see where they go next. They fail with that attempt. It doesn't really go anywhere. No one's really buying it. So they go on kind of smear campaign number 2. Let's start reading verse 10, just down to 13. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. He said, let us meet in the house of God and inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night they're coming to kill you. But I said, should a man like me run away? Or should someone like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sambala had hired him. He'd been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this. And then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. You probably got the basic gist of what they're trying to do here. They're trying to basically label him as a coward. Nehemiah, who's ready to hide in the temple as soon as the threat of people coming for him. At this time, they hire an inside man. So they hire someone on the inside to say to Nehemiah, hey, come hide in the temple, keep yourself safe. And it seems so reasonable and it seems so plausible, but Nehemiah sees through it. As soon as he shuts himself in the temple, they will say, look at Nehemiah, so scared of Sanballat and Tobiah that he had to take refuge in the temple. And then think about all those people who've been working on the wall despite all the threats they've received, despite all the people who said at any moment someone might come to kill you. These people who've been working, they then go, oh, what a hypocrite Nehemiah is. He wanted me to carry on with the work when it was my life at stake, but as soon as it's his life, he goes and hides in the temple. All of a sudden, those people who are working on the wall become that bit more afraid, become that much less inclined to work. But it doesn't work fundamentally because Nehemiah is clear. He must not run away. He must not go into the temple to save his life. So do you see what's going on here? Hopefully you've got like the general gist of the story. Multiple attempts to try and discredit Nehemiah, to try and ruin his reputation. Can they tempt him to do things that will compromise him, get him in a compromising position and take some photos? Can they make up some stuff about him? Can they tempt him to compromise? And I think, like I say, I don't want to label this, but I think there are some things for us to learn just when we face similar situations, when we face temptations to compromise, temptations to protect ourselves, when we face people speaking unfairly and untruly about us. What should we do? Let me read on verse 14. I'm going to read 14 down to 7, verse 3, and then that'll be it for this week. So let me read, and I'll just say a few bits about this. This is Nehemiah's response to all this. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, my gods, because what they have done. Remember also the prophet Noadiah and how she and the rest of the prophets have been trying to intimidate me. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. When our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our gods. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them, for many in Judah were under an oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Arah, and his son Jehoahan had married the daughter of Meshullam, son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds and telling me what I said, and telling him what I said, and Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. After the wall had been rebuilt, I had set the doors in place. The gatekeepers, the musicians, and the Levites were appointed. I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most people do. I said to them, the gates of Jerusalem are not to be opened until the sun is hot. While the gatekeepers are still on duty, make them shut the doors and bar them. Also appoint residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their posts and some near their own houses. Okay, I said I wouldn't spend too long, so let me try not to. Four things that might be helpful in terms of how we respond to false accusations. The first thing Nehemiah does is he just tries not to get drawn into it. So if you find yourself in that situation, if we find ourselves in that situation as a church, the first thing we can do is just try not to get involved. Verse 3, he refuses to go down to them. Verse 12, he refuses to go into the temple as they require. Nehemiah remains focused. What is it that God has called me to do? I'm not going to be distracted by the schemes and plots of others. Now, if we're honest, some of us struggle with that. Some of us struggle not to get sucked into every bit of drama that is happening around us. Some of us struggle not to get really wound up by everything people say about us. I think part of the lesson of this is just not to get sucked into it quite that easily. We don't need to feel the need to justify ourselves as soon as accusations start flying around. A lot of the time, we can just accept that we can't control what other people say about us, and we can just crack on with the work that God's given us to do. That's the first thing. The second thing that we need to do when this happens is we need to trust God. That's so central to Nehemiah's whole approach here. You see, Nehemiah was able to ignore them because fundamentally he trusts God. He doesn't have to justify himself because he can trust himself to God. Also, he doesn't have to ensure that justice is done to Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem. You see that in his prayer in verse 14. He just says, hey, God, you remember what they did. I'm going to leave them to you. Like, you can take the right view of what needs to happen to them. I don't need to do that. That is something we see talked about again and again in the Bible. We don't have to be the arbitrators of justice in the world. We don't have to do that. And it's a good job we don't have to do that, because we are horribly unqualified to do it. We are far too selfish, and so we tend to take things very personally and therefore overreact or underreact to them. And we're also nowhere near wise enough. Like, we don't know enough about what's going on to know what would or would not be just in a situation. And so one of the things the Bible repeatedly says to us is, at some point, you've just got to step away from that and say, hey, I trust this to you, God. We believe that God will administer both grace and justice, and we, as Christians, leave how he does that to him. That's for him to decide. We don't need to get drawn into that. We're not qualified. We need to let him do it. So we don't need to get drawn into everything. And the way you do that is by trusting a lot of it to God, not feeling like you have to sort out every problem. And then the third thing you have to do is keep on doing what God's called you to do. So don't let it distract you from the work that God's given for you, because that's what they want, right? That was the goal here. The whole goal was, can we distract them? Can we stop what they're doing? Well, we don't want to be stopped in what we're doing. We want to keep on going with the work that God has called us to do. However, and this is number four, in classic Nehemiah fashion, yes, he trusts God. And yes, he prays to him. You see that in verse 9, and you see that in verse 14. But what does Nehemiah always do when he prays to God? He then also acts. It's not like, oh, well, I pray to God, and so now I can just sit back and let God sort with it. He also acts. He's not so naive as to imagine that he can just ignore the opposition and everything will be okay. And really, that's what the beginning of chapter 7 is all about. You know that bit where it talks about the gates of Jerusalem not opened until the sun is hot? And also about who he appoints as rulers over Jerusalem, these people who fear God. This is Nehemiah taking precaution, saying, hey, there are people who want to tear down what we've done here, so we need to keep Jerusalem safe. So what he's saying is, the gates aren't going to be open for very long. Normally, you would open the gates at sunrise and close them at sunset. But instead, he's saying, actually, we're not going to open them for very long. We're going to wait until it's the middle of the day, and then we'll open them for a short period of time where they will be guarded, and then we'll close them. And I'm going to make sure that the people who rule over Jerusalem are people who fear God. You see, trusting God is not an excuse to be gung-ho. And the same is true for us. We still want to limit the risk that our opponents can cause mischief. I may not be able to control what people say about me or what people say about Grace Church. But I can try to avoid saying or doing things which will give people the opportunity to undermine us. And I can seek to be quick to apologize and own it when I've done something wrong, rather than trying to cover it up. And I can seek to try to act with integrity rather than self-interest, and therefore guard against some of the attacks which might come our way. This is where churches have so often failed, right? If you think about the history of scandals that have surrounded churches, they haven't done those things. You see, four things we can do when we find false accusations coming our way. We can stay out of it as much as possible. We can trust God, not trying to administer justice ourselves. We can not get distracted from the work that God has called us to do. And we can take the precautions that we need to. A few weeks ago, I watched the film The War of the Rohirrim. It's an animated film that is based in the world of Middle Earth. And I thought, I haven't talked about Lord of the Rings for a while, so I'll compensate by talking about War of the Rohirrim, which is kind of in the same world. Now, I've got a kind of activity I want you to do here, because I know it's hot and I know some of you are struggling to stay awake, so I'm going to give you something to do here. If you've seen this film, you are not allowed to join in this activity. So it's only for those of you in the room who haven't seen this film. I'm going to tell you what happens at the start of the film, And I want some people to guess what they think happens next, okay? So I'll tell you the start of the film, and those of you who are feeling brave can have a go at guessing. Now, I'm not expecting you'll get it all right, but we'll see where we go. So this is what happens, okay? It begins with two childhood friends, a girl and a boy. The girl is the daughter of the king of Rohan, and the son is the boy is the son of a rival chief. Okay, so this is the beginning set, two children, you know, playing nicely, fighting with a sword, you know, that kind of thing. And then the rival chief comes to the court to meet the king, and he says, "Why are you king? I want to be king." And the king and the rival chief have a fight. The king punches the chief only once, but it turns out to be fatal. The chief dies. The son, now a fully grown man, is furious about this and flies at the king, who then exiles him from the land. Right, have you got the setup? Have you kind of followed that? Have I described it? Okay, we'll give it a go. You got some bits. It's interesting. And as I was thinking about this, the first time I watched this, I said to Jack, I kind of felt a little bit like the story did everything you thought it was going to do. And then I watched it a second time and thought, oh, no, actually, there are a few bits where it could have gone two different ways. And you kind of talked about the two different ways it could have gone there. So it could go redemption arc with the son kind of seeing the error of his ways and, you know, being restored in. Or it could go the Timothy Hall way of the son being consumed by revenge and returning with an army to seek to get his revenge on the king. The story takes that story. It goes the Timothy Hallwell way. Well done. So the son returns with an army seeking revenge. The son kills the king. There's this kind of ongoing kind of tension between the son and the daughter, who were childhood friends and are now enemies. And eventually, the son is basically consumed by his desire for hatred and revenge. It all ends terribly sadly for him and happily for everyone else. Now, the question is, given that at the point that I left the story, literally anything could have happened, right? Okay, so like anything could have happened in that story. You know, pink unicorns could have turned up and created a financial system for them to run by. Or you could have had a whole film that was a dinner time discussion of the rights and wrongs of tribal leadership. Like anything could have happened in that story. So how come... like, we broadly speaking know the various places it could go. Like, how could you guess? And of course, the answer's obvious. It's because we've heard the story before, right? Like, we might not have watched this particular film, but we know we've heard these kind of stories over and over again. You know, we've heard the story of the exiled son who returns looking for revenge. We know stories of childhood friends who end up bitter enemies. We've heard stories where someone is consumed by their need for revenge. You know, we know these stories. We've heard them before. And so we can be fairly clear just from the beginning, okay, this is either going to be a redemption story or it's going to be a story of someone being consumed by their need for revenge. You know it's going to go in one of those two ways. Sure, we haven't seen this version of it before, but we know the story. Now, the reason I wanted to pull it out is because that is, in essence, how the Old Testament works. This book, all these pages, these hundreds of pages that come before you even get to the person of Jesus, what they do is they lay the groundwork for the great story which God is telling, so that when we hear that story, we go, oh, yeah, I've heard something a bit like that before. So that when God unveils his great plan, we don't look at it and go, what on earth is happening here? I've never seen anything like this before. But instead we go, oh yeah, that's a bit like this thing and this thing and this thing. Not quite the same, but a bit like. And Nehemiah 6 is actually doing that in such a clear way. Nehemiah 6 is actually preparing us for another leader who will in 500 years come to Jerusalem. And like Nehemiah, this leader will be accused of setting himself up as a king. Like Nehemiah, he will be accused of being a rebel, an insurrectionist. But unlike with Nehemiah, these accusations are going to stick. And they're going to stick so much that the ruling power, this time the Romans, not the Assyrians, will not only believe those accusations, but they will have him executed as a result of them, with a sign above his cross that says, King of the Jews. Like Nehemiah, this leader is going to be tempted to put his own safety ahead of the good of his people. As he approaches Jerusalem, he's going to have his friends say to him, don't go to Jerusalem, it's too dangerous. Stay out. He's going to have his closest followers call him to run away from Jerusalem, to save his life. And he's going to say, behind me, Satan. As he hangs on the cross, he's going to have people taunt him and say, if you are who you say you are, why don't you save yourself? And he's going to ignore those taunts because he knows that in order to rescue his people, he cannot save himself. Like Nehemiah, this leader is going to trust not only himself, but also his enemies to God's. And this time, though, he's not simply going to say, remember what they've done. He's going to do something even more remarkable. He's going to say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they've done. Like Nehemiah, this leader is going to complete his work of rebuilding God's kingdom, despite all of the opposition. But this time, rather than the walls being built in 52 days, it's going to only take 3 days for the curtain to be torn in two, for the grave to be overthrown, and for God's kingdom to be made available to all people. You see, you read Nehemiah 6, and you see a man of action, a man of faith, a man of integrity, a man who cares deeply for God's people. But the kingdom that Nehemiah is building will not last. The walls will again be destroyed. The people will again abandon God. Injustice and selfishness will again gain a foothold. No, Nehemiah was great, but he was still not good enough. But what he did do was he laid the groundwork for the man who would truly build God's kingdom. Not in a place, but across the whole globe, and whose work would ultimately last for eternity. I don't know about you, sometimes I long for a Nehemiah in my life. You know, someone who's just going to come, he's going to turn up and he's going to say, hey, look, I've got a vision for you. I've got something you can do. Get involved in this. I long for someone who can give me a vision, who can lead me, who can won't be tempted or corrupted, who will put my good and safety ahead of their own. Like, I long for that. I love that. And so many of us spend our lives looking for people like that. But actually, I don't need a Nehemiah, I need Jesus, because Nehemiah is in essence merely a warm-up act for the leader that we all need. The leader who will put our good ahead of his safety. The leader who will never be bribed or corrupted or intimidated. The leader we can follow and we can know will never disappoint us, will never let us down. You see, this is the call to the Christian life. This is what the call is. The call is to, in the person of Jesus, find our Savior, the one who lifts us out of the mess we've got into, offers us forgiveness and a new way of life, our Savior, but who also, to also find a Lord, a leader, a King, someone who we can follow. If you're someone here today who doesn't know Jesus, who isn't a Christian, I just want you to be clear, that's what the call is. That's what being a Christian is. It's to see in the person of Jesus someone who not only comes to rescue you, but who you can also go, hey, that's someone I want to follow. That's someone who I want to imitate. That's someone who I am so willing to lead me because I recognize how often I lead myself so badly. That's the Christian calling. If you're not a Christian here today, that's what we invite you to at Grace Church. If you are a Christian, you need to understand this. That's what it looks like. It looks like in Jesus to find the person who saw you at your worst and still loved you and forgave you, but who now leads you and says, hey, this is the work I've got for you. Come get involved. be a part of it. That's why we do everything we do at Grace Church. We do it so that people who don't know Jesus can come to know him, and so that people who do know him can follow him. That's why we're here. That's what it's about. And Nehemiah is just a little picture of that. A picture of Jesus who, when accusations were flung at him, when he faced opposition, when he was tempted, never allowed it to get in the way of him doing what God had called him to do. Let me pray, and then we'll finish.